Well, happy Friday to everybody. It's the podcast, the Bob McCowan Podcast. Yours truly, along with John Shannon in our smelly little homes. And joining us,
what? It's not smelly.
Well, speak for yourself. two of the icons of sports media in North America, around the world. In the top left of the corner, if you're watching on YouTube, Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. And the bottom right corner, Peter King of NBC. Gentlemen, great to have you with us. Let's get right at this. Watching last night's football game, Kansas City, Tennessee, and Ryan and I were chatting about this very briefly at the top. So, Bob, I'll throw it to you first. I guess they had 17,000 people there. Not everybody was wearing masks. COVID distancing was not taking place. It's just so easy to perceive the greed on the part of the Chiefs and the National Football League in the message that was being sent last night. Or is it just me?
Well, nothing surprises me with regard to mask and social distancing in America, depending on where you are and what people, you know, it's hopeless to try to get everybody to get on board. But the whole idea of playing football, whether it's professional or collegiate, I think is very dicey to start with. And nothing surprises me in that regard. It was disappointing. I'm not going to say I'm shocked. I'm way beyond the capacity for shock in almost anything, and certainly not in this regard. So I'll just say disappointing to see how that was handled.
Peter, it's your game. It's your business.
Here's the way that my understanding, and I've not done a lot of reporting on this, but my understanding is that fans at these games are in what was described to me as family pods. So in other words, if you and your family have season tickets to the Chiefs for the season, you're going to get to go to one or two games. You know, everybody is being offered the opportunity of getting to go to one or two games this year. And so if you, for instance, have a family of four, you will be assigned to sit together in a section. Okay. And so, I think the biggest issue that the NFL has, and I can guarantee you that they will be talking to the Chiefs about this, is they need to have ushers going around and telling people, if you're not eating, if you're not drinking, you must wear a mask. You get warned a second time, you're being kicked out. That's what has to happen here. You have to keep politics out of this. You just have to say, if you want to come to the game, you have to wear a mask, except if you're eating or drinking. Mm-hmm. Period. That has to be the rule. And, it obviously wasn't the rule in many cases last night. And the NFL's got to do something about it.
Well, you know what, Peter? There's only two cities that are going to allow fans, Kansas City and Jacksonville, at this point. You'd hope that there'd be lessons learned from last night. Roger Goodell was sitting there. We saw him sitting there watching it. So hopefully before Sunday, or before the first Jacksonville home game, there'll be some level of decision to assist them to try to make it a little more palatable for the rest of the country. By the way, Missouri and Florida are two states that have had real issues with COVID. So we shouldn't be surprised.
Well, the other thing, I saw the governor of Ohio, Prez, permitted Cleveland and Cincinnati to each have 6,000 fans in the stands, which is about a third of what we saw last night. I don't know whether that's going to materialize. I don't know whether there's a kickback, rushback on that philosophy, but we're going to see some people, some places. And one of the things I saw last night, Pete, was a shot early in the game of at least 100 or 200 people in a cluster in a single shot. That's a pretty big family.
It shouldn't be that way. My understanding is that one of the reasons that they did this the way they did it is so that people could be in small clusters together. Sure. And they would be you know, at least whatever, however many, 8 or 10 feet away from the next cluster. Yeah. So if there's all that many people together, you know, the ushers have got to do a better job, you know, in making sure that they honor what they say they're going to do when they enter the stadium.
One of the things we are experiencing here, among many other things, is a season without, well, with a training camp, but no preseason games. And I think we're all kind of intrigued by what we're going to get here. And there, I've heard the consensus out there that, you know, in the future, we're going to see one, maybe two preseason games. Mr. Ryan, is that a good idea?
Well, aesthetically, it's a good idea. In other words, I as a writer, I hated the preseason. It's covering them, covering exhibition, and I call them exhibition games.
Sure.
Yeah, they did it to make money. They didn't need four. I think two is reasonable. I think two games is reasonable, and I think that's the way I would advocate for in the future. That but four was not. Now, remember, in the old old days, Peter probably remembers, we're talking
six.
Five or six.
There was six.
I mean, yeah. When I first became of age as a football fan, because of basketball was crazy. They played 18 or 20. I mean, the world's very different now. But the fact is that they did play that many, and they got it down to four. And we all know how it worked. The first one, you know, your regulars didn't play, and it was the kids. And the second one, and the third one was the real one. And then the fourth one was nobody get hurt game. You know, we all know that. That was a universal procedure. Yep. That was, so it was kind of a joke. Anybody that paid money for it was getting ripped off. But so I'm going to guess it's going to settle that they'll be able to get a compromise and go to two.
But Peter, isn't that enough of a revenue driver when you think that the teams get all the local television and those local TV stations pay a lot of money and they're part of your season ticket package? I don't know how you're going to dwindle it down.
The big fight over the years has been that the NFL and the owners, just as you say, those are $1 million evenings, okay, for NFL teams. So the owners who already this year are going to lose, I shouldn't say are going to lose money. They're going to make about, on average, about $75 to $90 million less per franchise because of all the restrictions on home attendance, local revenue, all that. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a lot of money. And so next year, owners are going to be looking to make that up any way they can. So in an ideal world, I agree with Bob. Two preseason games are the absolute right number. One of them is a game where your first string plays about half the game for most teams. But there are also going to be coaches like Sean McVay. Last year, I think there were 9 players on the Rams last year who did not play one snap in the preseason, including Jared Goff. He just views it, Sean McVay and many coaches just view it as just simply too dangerous. I would rather have a team that is raw than a team that is out. And so that's basically, I think, what the real issue is. But I would say next year, there's either going to be 2 or 3 preseason games because it's long past time to recognize that these are just simply money grabs.
Well, we grow up watching high school football when we went there mostly, and there really aren't any exhibition games there. And we watch college football, and there really aren't any exhibition games there. And the product in week one when Ohio State plays Cheeseball State seems to be okay. We don't notice a dramatic difference in it.
But you don't care.
The product last night was fine.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, the argument that you have to have these preseason games in order to be ready for the regular season. Well, if everybody's on the same plane, Mr. Ryan, isn't that the issue?
Well, yeah, I think so. I always thought one of the primary reasons to have them over and above the money-making factor was getting your roster set, looking at new talent, finding out, you know, better than practice who can play and can't play on your roster. You could make a team by Peter will speak to this. He's much more conversant with the topic than I. But I thought that was at least part of the reasoning. And if you take that away, then that's a, you know, one less way of being able to evaluate your talent.
Peter, are we going to miss the 65 guys that have opted out?
I doubt it. You know what struck me last night? The Kansas City Chiefs, probably, you know, it's either coincidental or some degree of great planning by this team. 20 of 22 starters return, 20 of 21 coaches return. And the one starter that everybody is worried about is a Canadian, Laurent mm-hmm. Duvernay-Tardif. And last night, I think Chris Collinsworth must have highlighted his sub, Kelechi Osemele, about six times with how great he was playing. And so I felt bad. I kept thinking, man, Duvernay-Tardif is sitting up in, north of Montreal or wherever he is. He's sitting up there watching this. And he's probably depressed as hell because the Chiefs don't miss him at all. but I don't really think. I mean, look, last night was a perfect example of this. I'm using the note in my Monday column about the opt-outs. And the two big opt-outs for the Chiefs were Laurent Duvernay-Tardif and Damian Williams, the running back who scored the last two touchdowns in the Super Bowl, had a 100-yard rushing game in the Super Bowl. So what happens last night? Clyde Edwards-Helaire, the first round pick, rushes for 138 yards, and Kelechi Osemele plays great as the sub for Duvernay-Tardif. And so, look, the NFL is very good at making people disappear and being just fine without them. That's the history of the NFL. They create stars in about 10 minutes. And last night, the created star was Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
With Peter King and Bob Ryan on the podcast today. Well, Mr. King, you are, among other things, you make predictions at the beginning of the season. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you did not have the Kansas City Chiefs, the defending champions, win the Super Bowl again. In fact, you don't even have them going to the Super Bowl again. Am I wrong?
That's correct. Yeah. I'm most often when I make my picks, I make my picks using history as my guide. And history says that no matter how great a team looks in September, 15 years in a row, that team that looked so great in September didn't look so great in January. And I don't know why, but it's been 15 years since there's been a repeat champion. You know, the Patriots of 2003 and 2004. And there have been some really great teams in the meantime. I mean, the Green Bay Packers 10 years ago won the Super Bowl and went 15-1 the next year and didn't repeat.
That's right.
And they didn't even make it. And so it's just, look, I spent some time, on Zoom or one of these things with Andy Reid about 3 weeks ago. We spent about a half hour. And one of the things he said to me when I talked to him about continuity, I said, hey, you got 20 of 22 starters back, 20 of 21 coaches. I don't remember ever in the Super Bowl era a team being almost the exact same team coming back the next year. You know, you guys look like you're in great shape. And he goes, hey, Peter, we were down by double digits in every one of our playoff games. So, the Chiefs were fantastic last year, but let's remember, they need a miracle, almost Hail Mary, from Patrick Mahomes to Tyreek Hill on 3rd-and-14 with 7 minutes and 35 seconds left, down 10 points
to have a chance.
San Francisco, to have a chance to win that game. And so I the Chiefs on September 11th looked like the best team in football, but September 11th is also not January 11th. We'll see.
Well, intriguingly, the team you picked to win the Super Bowl is Tampa Bay. You pick them over Baltimore. And that raises, of course, the Brady question. And fortunately, we got two guys who can look at this from a valid perspective. Mr. Ryan, you have watched Mr. Brady play for your essentially hometown team for 20 years.
Yes.
Is he still good enough to lead Tampa Bay to the promised land?
I think with the proper supporting offensive weaponry, the answer is yes. He did not have that in up here in the last couple of years. The receiving core was depleted, and that was just simply that. And the tight end situation, once he left Gronkowski, was never rectified. So I think he's diminished. He's 43. The arms, the accuracy is not there. I can tell you, I watched him bounce passes behind people, overthrow, underthrow, and things you didn't see 10 years ago, and it, more than you would ever see. But he's still, I said 2 years ago, if he deteriorates by 10%, he's still in the top 10 quarterbacks. If he deteriorates, I still think he's in the top 10 to 15, 12 quarterback. That's good enough. One of the great myths in football, in my opinion, is that you have to have a great quarterback play to win a Super Bowl. You have to have adequate play to get the job done. We've had some mediocre quarterbacks that actually flash rings at you. Hello, Joe Flacco. And so it can happen. This team he's got now, you've got to give him a chance. Absolutely. I think he's got and he's going to be emboldened by this. He's going to be, renewed and vigor and enthusiastic. He's got his old buddy back. For third down, Gronkowski, assuming that he's still got the same physical ability he had. So, yes, I think Brady is good enough, and that's all you got to be. You don't have to be MVP caliber. You don't have to be all Pro Bowl caliber. You have to be good enough. And don't forget, there's two sides of the ball, and, you only have to score more sure. points than the other team.
Peter, you obviously agree because you picked Tampa Bay, right?
Here's the way I look at it. One thing about Tampa Bay is everybody looks at them as the Buccaneers. Well, Tampa Bay turned the ball over 41 times last year, which is the most in the NFL since the Browns of 3 years ago. And that Browns team went 0-16. So for the Bucs to have won seven games and to they would have won nine if Jameis Winston didn't throw six passes to the other team in the last two games of the season, including his final pass, which was a walk-off pick six, his last pass in Bucs history.
Right.
So I guess my overriding point is that Tom Brady is not going to the Jacksonville Jaguars. Everybody thinks that the Bucs are awful. They're the same old Bucs. They're not. This is top-to-bottom receiver group, the best receiver group with tight ends that Tom Brady has ever had, ever. So you look at this and you basically say, especially after Tom Brady coming from a receiver group last year that Pro Football Focus, tight end, wide receivers, had number 32 in the NFL. And so, it's just common sense, first of all, that unless Brady gets zero time, or he's got zero chemistry, and I doubt either of those things are going to happen. I think they're going to have an upgrade. Now, is it good enough to win the Super Bowl? I mean, it's going to be very, very hard in the NFC, especially because it's going to be hard for them to not only not win home field, but to even win that division with the Saints in it.
Peter, you talk about chemistry. Can you compare chemistry between Brady and Arians versus Brady and Belichick?
Well, the most amazing thing when I talked to Brady 3 weeks ago now, 4 weeks ago now, he said, do you realize this is my 30th year of playing football, high school, college, pro, 30th year of playing football. And this is the first year ever that I have had an offensive head coach. And so I went back and checked. So at Sarah High School in California, he had a defensive head coach, an old linebacker. He had a defensive head coach at Sarah High. Then he goes to Michigan for 5 years, and he's got Lloyd Carr, who's a defensive coach. And then obviously Belichick for 20 years. So that's 29 years in a row where the coach is of a defensive mindset. Now, look, Bill Belichick knows everything about everything. So I'm not saying that he was in some disadvantaged place. He certainly wasn't. But it has been refreshing for Tom Brady. A couple of days before I got to training camp, Bruce Arians told me that he and Brady sat in his office, shut the door, and he said, "Tom, tell me the plays you like to run." And as Arians told me, he goes, "I'm going to call him. You know, we got so many good weapons here that what he likes, I know we can make work." So I have a feeling that, you know, again, Brady is so demanding that, you know, look, if Cameron Braid isn't up to the task or Chris Godwin isn't up to the task or whatever, he's just going to move on to the next guy. He's going to be brutally honest with them if somebody does not fit, you know, what he thinks they ought to be doing.
We invariably start a season with expectations, and some of those expectations don't materialize. There is almost inevitably a team that surprises everybody, that comes kind of out of the blue. And many times we are able to look back at the beginning of the season and said, should have seen that coming. Bob Ryan, is there a team that jumps out at you that you think might be ready to take the next step?
It's funny because I definitely subscribe to that theory that somewhere lurking is a 3-13 team waiting to become a 12-4 team. But this isn't a 3-13 team, but they got no excuse to get it done this year. Buffalo Bills in the division, finally. That division, the tyranny is over. It should be over.
tyranny.
So I just think they have a potential to do that. If you like, am I being mocked here or not? I don't know.
No, I love that. I love that the tyranny is over.
Yeah, I think it is. And, I mean, it's
just saying it should be over.
Thing.
Bills fans have been saying that for years.
I know. I'm well aware. And even in that division, the other, you know, because Miami is turn a corner, I think. Brian Flores has turned out to be, he was almost rookie of the year coach-wise. I mean, he was terrific. And he's got things going. But I'm just saying, I'll say maybe Buffalo, the time has come. And I know they've heard that one up there before. Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Pete, you got one?
You know, there's two teams that I picked to make the playoffs that generally I got raised somewhere between raised eyebrows and scoffing when I picked them. And I picked Detroit to make the playoffs in the NFC, theorizing that last year at midseason when Matthew Stafford went down, they were the fourth best offense in football statistically. So, you know, he went down with a fluky injury. I think if he stays healthy, they got a chance to be very explosive. And the team in the AFC I like is the Raiders. If you watch the way that Mike Mayock is drafted, this has basically been with the Raiders. This is a referendum on big-time players at big-time schools. Okay, he's like, you know, Bob Ryan and I will remember, and you guys might remember too, you know, in the 60s, they used to play this thing called the College All-Star Game.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, and we're talking about, Bob and I were just talking about how, you know, a long time ago, there were 6 preseason games. Can you imagine the best seniors in college football actually had to play 7 preseason games a long time ago? Because the best of the best went to, I think they usually played in Chicago.
Chicago.
They would go to Soldier Field and they would play an exhibition game against the best, the defending champion of the NFL. And so just imagine, you know, you that is the way it used to be. And that is what, to me, GM Mike Mayock of the Raiders is trying to recreate. He just picked every good player from Clemson, Ohio State, and Alabama. He did it again this year with Henry Ruggs, the receiver from Alabama. So I kind of look at what the Raiders are doing as a referendum on how to build a team in today's day and age. Let's take the guys who have played in the biggest games, and many of them have won the biggest games in college football, and let's put them all together. Let's put this all-star team together and see if Carr can get them the football, at least in the you know, as we refer to with Ruggs, you know, the receiver position.
Before we move off of football, Mr. Ryan, you haven't given us your Super Bowl selection as yet. Mr. King has gone public. Would you like to take a shot at this?
Well, I haven't. I famously disdained and railed and ranted about having to make predictions when I was active at the Globe. I think, you know, the only predictions that are worth it are the ones backed by your bankroll, in my opinion. However, I haven't given it a deep dive thought in this year yet. So I would just say, random. I'm throwing a Hail Mary here. A team with talent, a team that there's always a what if. There's always there's expectations that usually exceed the reality. Dallas Cowboys. Still got talent.
Yeah. Hey, before it, I just want to ask about one more guy because they were such a factor for a long period of time, and both of you have probably positive opinions. Is what's Cam Newton going to do for the Patriots? And where is and can Bill Belichick and Jeff, can that coaching staff make him more responsible and make the Patriots a factor?
I mean, look, about 14 months ago in his last training camp in Spartanburg, South Carolina with the Carolina Panthers, I spent about 20 minutes with Cam Newton. And he talked very openly about changing the way he was going to play quarterback. He can't expose himself to the amount of punishment and the number of hits that, you know, that he had been exposing himself to. And so now he goes to New England. I would love to be able to say, I've got great confidence in Cam that he's going to do X, Y, and Z. I don't know if he's going to be a pocket quarterback, if he's going to be the multifaceted weapon that won the MVP 5 years ago, if he's going to be somewhere in between. I just don't know what kind of player he's going to be, but there's no reason why he can't play well. There's no reason why the Patriots can't win this year. But I would just make one point about the Patriots. It has been all Cam all the time, understandably. It's a great chemistry experiment to have Cam Newton and Bill Belichick together, but they lost four starting linebackers. The linebackers are the key to the Bill Belichick offense. So if Josh Uche, the rookie from Michigan, who I'm very high on, Anfernee Jennings from Alabama, Juwan Bentley, these guys who America hasn't heard of, you know, if they don't play well, you know, the Patriots, Cam Newton's going to have to score 33 points a game for the Patriots to have a chance. And they never upgraded their receiver position. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I didn't pick the Patriots.
I want to get to a couple things quickly before we let you guys go. I know you're both big baseball guys. We have a unique season this year, 60 games because of COVID. We have expanded playoffs. And expanded playoffs has been something I've been harping on for years, decades. I like playoffs. Playoffs interest me. The NBA mini season and then into the playoffs, I've watched more playoff games in the NBA than I would any other time. Because playoffs mean something to me. It's not just another game.
Right.
So we're going to see expanded playoffs in baseball. Do you guys think it's a good idea to extend this in the years to come into 162 or reduce it to 154 game season? Is expanded playoffs in baseball an idea that should be pursued? Bob Ryan, to you first.
I'm afraid I'm going to become the old get off my lawn traditionalist here. I'd like to go back to when you had a World Series as your postseason.
No
but
playoffs
I know
at
that's
all.
Not going to happen. We're talking now 51 years. 51 years since we had 52 since we had since baseball changed its mind about that. Okay, answer is whatever they do this year, Bob, is okay with me. This is an aberrational year. including the guy on second base, which I hate, but I'll put up with it this year at the start of the 10th inning. Whatever they do this year is fine, but it does open the door for more. I don't want any more. I think they've got enough. I don't think we need expanded playoffs in baseball. I really don't. Because here's the thing about baseball. I mean, this is elementary. It's ABC. The season, it's antithetical to the nature and essence of the game. With a 162-game season, baseball's essence is much different. It's twice as long as the next two than hockey and basketball. You want to reward people for the long haul, more people with more advantages than the short haul that reward that you get in hockey and baseball and the other team's playoffs. So I know how it goes, and I think that it's going to be agitation to extend it next year. I hope they don't.
Well, Bob, I'd mostly agree with Bob Ryan, but I will. I mean, first of all, the thing that bothers me about, you know, eight teams in the playoffs in baseball is that invariably what this will mean for those eight teams in baseball is that, let's say you do this next year. You have the eight teams in. The first series is a three-game series. What is it? It's best two out of three. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah.
So let's just say that you play two out of three, even if all three games, which I think is a great idea, all three games at the team with the better record. I think that's fair. Okay, that's fair. But let's just say that you're going to have eight of those series, four in the American League, four in the National League. Okay, so what you were doing right there, here's what you're doing. You are saying, let's say next year, as this year all bets are off, but next year you say, okay, we're going to play 162 games or 154, and then eight teams are going to be out after three games. And it's great to have the whole sudden death thing in sports. Everybody loves that. I love it. But sudden death in an unfair vein, which I really think it is, to basically say, okay, first team to win two games, you know, you are either out or you're in. And I just think after playing, what are you playing 162 games for? You know, you're playing all these games. I would be much better to play, let's say, 148 games if then you then said, okay, every series is going to be a best out of seven, you know, because then you're
okay
going to
with
get
that.
The real judge. Sure. You'll get the real judge. I don't like the one game wild cards. I don't like the best of three series in baseball. If you're going to play, let's find out who the real best team is. And you only do that if you play a decent number of games.
Well, I've got no issue with that whatsoever. In fact, I've done an economic comparison, and the truth of the matter is, baseball would actually make more money if they had more teams in the playoffs and fewer regular season games.
As long as there was revenue sharing, Bob, for everybody. I mean, if I was one of those teams that was, you know, 42 and 112 every year, I don't mind doing it as long as I'm sharing in your wealth at your home games and playoffs.
Well,
that's the only way it's going to happen.
Look, at the two things that happen is we all know that once you get to postseason anything, the price of tickets goes astronomically higher, and the value of the television broadcast and the radio broadcast goes higher as well. Now, I know that those aren't broken out necessarily, but they are in contract negotiations. And we also know that if you get to September and you're one of those 42-win teams, you got nobody in the stands. You're lucky to draw 10,000, you might draw 5,000 people. The more teams that are competitive, the more teams that are in the mix, the greater your revenue is going to be from regular season games. Mr. Ryan's nodding his head.
That's the best argument for it. I always have understood that. You know, I can, because, you know, that's not my direct personal interest to worry about those teams, but I understand that concept. And yes, it does work that way. We've lived it. The Red Sox have won a World Series without winning the division. You know, so And plenty of teams have now. And so that's, we're used to that. I understand that. And I do agree with that. I just argue as a baseball purist that, you know, it's just antithetical. The 162 long haul game should, right. Victor should be guaranteed a lot of perks. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. And, but wouldn't you agree, Mr. Ryan, that if it was 148 or 154 yeah. games, like, would you or I or John or Peter miss those 16 no, games?
The only reason you miss the games is for statistical history.
Sure.
Because then you're going to say, well, Jacob DeGrom didn't have to do the same thing to win the Cy Young that Greg Maddux did and all that. And I understand that, but I don't think it's worth – you know, going down from, let's say, 162 to 148 games, I think would make the quality better. And if you're going to play every series in the postseason, best of seven, all right. it'd give you more playoffs. And you know what else that would mean, Bob? That would mean that you could start the playoffs on, let's say, like September 18th.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
something, and you'd have 2 weeks so that you wouldn't be playing a playoff game on November 8th. You know, you can't do that. You don't want to do that.
See, the interesting thing, Peter, what you talk about is I think the 60 game schedule will give Major League Baseball license to do exactly what we talk about when it comes to statistics. They don't have to worry about it as much yeah. anymore, and it's made us forget Houston cheated. Those are the only two things that's happened in baseball yeah. this summer, you know. So, I mean, a shorter season, better playoffs, longer playoffs, just don't play in November. I'm happy with it.
All right, last topic I want to just touch on real quickly before I let you guys wander off for the day. And I know Mr. Ryan will be compelled by this. Peter, a little bit less, although he conceded before we started this podcast that he did watch parts of the Raptors-Celtics Game 6. We got a game 7 tonight with Boston and Toronto. It is a primetime game. I think it starts at 9 o'clock Eastern time,
nice.
Which they haven't had yet. And I think it is has been a compelling series. And game 6 was about as good as you can get. Bob Ryan, what's the sense in Boston?
Apprehension and a lot of people saying, they got to get it done. That Brad Stevens needs this to justify everything that they've knocked on the door before, and they fallen short. And you know, and I think this is unfair. First of all, we didn't the Gordon Hayward situation. They lost him. Didn't have him the whole series. But anyway, yeah, people. And also, the sword had the thing. The cloud hanging over everything is that game 3.5. And I'm telling you right now, if the Raptors win this series, Peter, you'll like this. The 0.5 will be to the Celtics fandom as 28-3 is to the Falcons fandom. It's going to be the 28-3 of basketball, 0.5. The most amazing juxtaposition in playoff history, really. They've been games won at the buzzer. But the way that transpired was unique. Yeah. And it was devastating. And if the Raptors win, it's going to be – they'll be harping on that 0.5 all winter.
Yeah, I'm sort of fortunate that I'm not a basketball head at all. But when I was a little kid growing up in Northern Connecticut, I was a Celtics fan. Now, I haven't been one in 30 years, and I haven't really followed basketball very closely. But I occasionally, flipping the channels, will turn it on. And that the night of that game, I just said to myself, man, Kemba Walker is an incredible competitor, diving around, just really playing hard, playing his rear end off the whole way. And then the way it ended was so incredibly exciting. So I just thought the other night, you know, I was going to watch the game, and I watched most of the second half and both overtimes. And it's what sports should be. It is gigantic play after gigantic play being made. These shots. Kyle Lowry is unbelievable. And so, look, I come at it from the perspective, I don't really care. You know, And I just look at the game for sport. That game is one of the best athletic contests I've seen. And that is one of the reasons why I'm really kind of looking forward to tonight. And I feel bad. I would assume that the winner of this series is going to have to play on Sunday against Miami, right? And what possibly are they going to have left in the tank to play on Sunday? It's going to, I mean, whoever wins this game, it's like this is round 15 of Rocky Balboa and Apollo Creed, man. Who in the world can take a punch now?
Just flashed across my mind, Bob and Peter and John, the little aspects of the 1960 World Series here. If the Raptors win a close game tonight, because they got pounded twice.
Yep.
They got it handed to them twice.
Yep.
Big time. Two wire to wires, as we like to say in basketball. They never trailed the Celtics, and yet they could lose this series. They've demonstrated demonstrable superiority for many stretches of this series, and yet here they are facing a seventh game. And if they lose a close game, this is going to remind me of the 60 World Series, which, if people don't know, the Pirates were outscored badly by the Yankees, but they managed to win that series. They lost a 16-3 game, they lost a 12-1 game, and they won the series. That would be the Raptors. I'll say something, Bob and guys, they have shown such heart all season. They have played with the big boulder right here all year. All right, we don't have Kawhi, right? That doesn't mean we're dead. Everybody wrote him off, and they keep showing me some spunk. I really admire them. And I'm not in the mainstream here with people who are whining and groaning. If the Celtics lose to that team, I'm not going to feel bad. I'm going to say I can live with this as a fan. Yeah. The fan in me can live with this as opposed to losing to some other team under some other circumstances. And, yeah, that 0.5 is going to hurt. But that's their own damn fault. Cover the guy. Sure. Right? So I'm okay. I admire the Raptors. I think they've come out of this one way or the other. They've come out of this with tremendous respect.
I think that I really think that game six was a wake up call for a lot of basketball fans across the continent, that this basketball team is almost as good as last year's. And that they do have enough dimension, and Ananobi's made a difference at both ends, that unlike Peter, I think the team that wins this series goes to the final. I think Boston goes to the final, or the Raptors go to the final, and the Raptors have an opportunity to repeat if they can win. Siakam has to be better. He was pretty good in the second half. Gasol was better in the second half. That was a really good positive for the Raptors.
Do you think Canada is rooting for Kawhi to make it? If Toronto gets in, would Canada like to see Clippers, Raptors?
Well, it's interesting because Mr. McCowan can identify with this. LeBron's got a real following here still, because remember Cleveland used to come and beat the Raptors every time in the playoffs. Yeah. So if it's Kawhi or it's LeBron, it's going to be a great story if the Lakers or Clippers get to the NBA Finals.
Look, I can answer that question, and John's right. It's the Canada Raptor fans know that the Raptors have never beaten LeBron. He is the dark hole.
We don't
hate Kawhi. Kawhi brought us a championship, at least, quote unquote. So, and he left, and we were disappointed, whatever. But there's a good team still here. But LeBron,
we don't
hate him, but we sure would like to beat him once.
Let's also put this in perspective. The three of you will appreciate this. The ratings on television in Canada for Game 6 versus the Stanley Cup playoffs, which I know both Bob or Peter know that they're still on. Yes, they are.
Yeah, 4-5-1. They beat them.
There was 1.6 million watching the basketball game and 600,000 watching the hockey game. They beat them by a million viewers in our country. That's a massive number. So there's a lot of people at networks with fingers crossed that the Canadian representative of the NBA can continue tonight in order to get some pretty good ratings across the country. Raptors have become Canada's team.
Just want to throw this one in. The Canadian imprint on the NBA is significant and is growing. And the greater Ontario and Toronto area is becoming a real incubator.
Sure.
And you know, I think it's great. And how about, and then the Steve Nash news is great, you know, for people in Canada too. I'm really, as a basketball guy, I welcome this. I think it's wonderful that Canada has become so interested in basketball.
We got to get out of here. Pete, thanks for the tour of the house, by the way.
You're welcome.
Unintentional.
Hey, hold on, Bob. Hey, Bob, a Canadian invented basketball. What are you talking about? A Canadian invented basketball.
Yeah, but he did it in the United States. Guys, you know, we love you both, and we've spent a lot of time together, not necessarily in this format in the past, and we hope we can have the opportunity to do it again. Thanks so much for your time today, and good health. We'll see you soon, I hope.
You're welcome. Great seeing you guys.
Cheers.
Peter King of NBC, Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. That's the podcast. Have a nice weekend, everybody.